It is Friday, January the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, Trump Korea policy, functional or dysfunctional?
If that leads to what diplomats might find to be dysfunctional strategies, you know, how do you, bite the hand that feeds you, or whatever metaphor you want to use, kick the person who you're seeking to bring into cooperation, I don't think that matters too much, Dan.
Human Rights Watch calling on leaders to fight populism, U.S. rejecting supporting IS in Afghanistan, plus a special kind of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. When athletes from the rival Koreas paraded together behind a single flag for the first time at the opening ceremony of the 2000 Sydney Olympics, it was a highly emotional event that came on a wave of hope for reconciliation following their leaders' first-ever summit talks. Well, the Koreas plan to do this again next month at the Olympics in South Korea. It's not clear what happens after those Olympics. But U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says tough new sanctions are having an impact on North Korea, and he says China's efforts have also had an impact. VOA's Lori London talks to former U.S. Ambassador and current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Mutter, who just returned from a trip to Asia, talks about China's involvement in all of this, plus how long might the détente between the North and South continue.
What the Chinese are clearly trying to do is to portray to the Americans, I think this happened in the phone call that President Xi had with President Trump, they're trying to portray to the Americans that things are getting better. That is to say that the American effort to try to put pressure on North Korea is working. That's something that I think many sources in the United States would dispute. They say as long as this guy keeps testing missiles and coming up with angry rhetoric, that we have to prepare, and there's a lot of statements, sober preparations for war. You hear this from Tillerson, you hear this from Mattis. But the Chinese are trying to talk to Trump and to others and just to say, you know, this is really working. Stick with it. It's going to be okay. And I think that in the immediate future, what will be interesting is that there's a kind of a temporary truce going on because of the decision by the North Koreans and South Koreans to field a common team at the Olympics in South Korea over the next couple of weeks. But my suspicion is that will end fairly quickly, and here are two ways it'll end. One, the Olympics will end, and there will be a lot of people then who will want to say, okay, that was nice, but the Americans, for example, put off joint military maneuvers with the South Koreans, and there are indications that the North Koreans are making preparations for military maneuvers themselves. So that could be delayed, but they could happen again. Secondly, and I think more important, there's, I think, a sense that the president in the United States, in American domestic politics, is likely to lash out at the Chinese. Whether it's for populist reasons along the lines of his criticism about NAFTA and Canada on trade, that he could lash out at the Chinese about trade and about the Chinese for what are perceived as unfair trade practices and unfair limitations on American economics. And that would make it less likely that the Chinese would be as accommodating as they've been both privately and in public.
Where would that strategy get you when you go after on the attack with the country that you need to help you
My take in a very general sense is that foreign policy is basically secondary to Trump. Foreign issues, he's not talking to the Chinese, he's not talking to the Mexicans, he's talking to his constituents, the people who he just gave his speech, I guess even today, out in Pittsburgh. He's convinced that he will be keeping his promise to his domestic constituency, and one of those things is standing up for what he sees as unfair practices that hurt American workers. And if that leads to what diplomats might find to be dysfunctional strategies, you know, how do you, bite the hand that feeds you, or whatever metaphor you want to use, kick the person who you're seeking to bring into cooperation, I don't think that matters too much to you. This is not, to me, a diplomatic plan. This is a domestic political plan that will make it harder to come to a coherent prospect for diplomatic cooperation with the Chinese against North Koreans.
Do you think that the North and South Koreans, or this show of unity right now, do you think that this was a strategic move on the North's part to sort of drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea?
I think so. I think that it was both that, and I think that, looking at it from the perspective as it's been described to me by North Korea experts, are that there's always an effort by the North Koreans to try to figure out creative ways to try to make themselves palatable given that their long-term interests or long-term goals are the reunification of the Korean Peninsula under North Korean auspices. You know, we talk about a reunification, the prospect of a reunification that could be like, you know, West Germany, East Germany, where the strong economic power kind of eats up the small, weak one. That's not the way the North Koreans see it. So they're doing two things. They're pursuing their efforts to try to, whether you think it's effective or not, they're trying to say, here's us trying to work on a future of unity in Korea. And then secondly, doing what you suggested, drawing, putting a wedge between the South Koreans and the Americans. My personal take is that while it is tactically effective and it makes it look that way for now, I don't know that that's going to last because of other behavior having to do with American politics and also the determination by Kim Jong-un to continue testing.
You mentioned the comments made by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
The word I read was that he said, we need to be sober about this. What you've heard from other, you know, commanders in Korea and from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and from Mattis is, and I think even from McMaster, is that they are taking this seriously as a real possibility. Everyone else I talk to in Asia is horrified that people would talk this way. They hope what it is a bargaining position. But from people from Southeast Asia, people from China, et cetera, are horrified by the apparent acceptance of the United States that war is an option.
What do you think they mean?
I think there are probably some people in the United States, as evidenced by the recent comments about the, I don't know if you followed the bloody nose comments, there was talk about how there might be ways to get the attention to punish North Koreans by military action short of an all-out war. That is, to do something that would punish them, but they would make saying, but this wouldn't lead to the spread of hostilities. It can be contained. For most of us, especially those of us who served in places like Iraq and other places in the world, that simply doesn't sound likely. It doesn't. All the maxims that you have about, you know, this kind of armed conflict is that once you begin hostilities, the predictability element goes way, way, way down. So there are those in the government who are trying to make a coherent argument, they think a convincing argument, that there is such a thing as military action that won't lead to the kind of the horrific things that people have heard of, the many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of casualties. So that's one maybe faction in the United States. There's another faction that says, and I think this is probably more widespread, which is aim for peace but prepare for war. Be tough. And this is, I think, the encouragement they're getting from the president. Be tough, say we mean it, say we really are not willing to accept a nuclear North Korea, and make those kinds of preparations.
That is former U.S. Ambassador and the current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter, speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. The entire Western Cape province of South Africa, including the burgeoning tourist haven of Cape Town, home to nearly 4 million people, is in the grips of the worst drought in a century, with the growing prospect of city officials. They say they'll be turning off piped water by April 22nd, when water supplying the dams sink to 13.5% capacity. Well, Bruce Hewitson, a climatologist at the University of Cape Town, told VOA's Victor Beatty the region is suffering from 3 years of below-normal rainfall and needs of a growing population.
And, of course, the dams are planned on a multi-year storage cycle, and so after 3 years of below-normal rainfall, we are down to critical levels.
Is this a typical pattern that you've seen in southern Africa, or is this unusual?
We have multi-year droughts. This is a particular bad multi-year drought. There is precedence for extensive droughts like this before, But we do think that the current multi-year drought we're experiencing is probably a one in a few hundred year event. And of course, with the growth of demand from the growing city, that compounds the issues and puts us in this crisis position.
What is that position right now? Exactly what are people being restricted to? And what is so important about April 22nd?
What we're looking at is under current demand and usage rates by the population, the resources are going to run dry at some point. And depending on how you calculate that, you can get a variable number of dates. But we are looking that in the next couple of months, unless we can supplement the supply substantially and reduce the demand even further, the city will run out of piped water delivery. And that is the danger point, because of the consequences that cascade from that are substantial.
Tell me about desalination plants. Are there efforts underway to increase the water supply?
Yeah, there are a number of activities on the go. We have different aquifers we can draw upon. There's a sort of shallow aquifer, there are deep aquifers. The deep ones are a concern in some respects because it's what we perhaps call fossil water. It takes a long time to recharge that water. But there are supplies coming online from that. The desalinization plans are also on way, and there are some small plants being established for that. Of course, the challenge is how quickly you can do this. We are facing a day zero, as it were, in the next couple of months, and it takes time to put a lot of these measures in place. Some of the measures are online already, more coming online, but we still have to think about demand management substantially as well. The city population really has to bring down its consumption if we're going to get through this.
Are there reports that people are heeding the warnings?
Yes. There are all sorts of measures to try and encourage people. Everything from forced restriction on high-demand users or people of the city coming in and putting restrictions on the supply into an individual house if they're a high-demand user. Many people who are working well below the target limit of 87 litres per person per day. And that 87 litres is not drinking water. That's entire for hygiene, showering, everything that you need to do. And many people are substantially below that. I know people who are operating on the order of 15 to 20 liters a day, which is remarkable.
That's Bruce Huertsen. He is a climatologist at the University of Cape Town. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Also in the news, the United States has reiterated its resolve to help local forces eliminate the Islamic State fighters from Afghanistan and have strongly refuted accusations that Washington was behind the emergence of the terrorist group in that country. U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan John Bass says the United States had no role in the emergence of the IS group, also known as Daesh, in Afghanistan.
Let me take this opportunity, since these rumors continue to circulate, to emphatically state that the United States has not brought Daesh to Afghanistan. The United States has not ever supported Daesh, its creation, its horrible attacks in any form or fashion.
IS operates in Afghanistan under the name the Khorasan Province. Terrorist group launched its operations in early 2015 from eastern volatile Afghan regions, mainly Nangarhar, that's the province bordering Pakistan. It's time now to take a look at what's trending on social media. VOA's Doug Bernard here with what's happening. What you got, Doug?
Well, you may have heard that yesterday was the much anticipated, at least by some people, fakies, or the fake news awards that President Donald Trump has been promising to release for several weeks now and hyping along the way. Yesterday, he took to the internet to announce 11 winners of what he's calling the fake news awards. It's probably not many people actually got to see it, though, because as about a minute after or so he was up on the web, the site crashed and they weren't able to get any audio or video out. But still, nonetheless, the Senate Republican National Committee released the 11 and his comments on them. CNN, quote, wins with 4 of the 11 awards. The Washington Post and the New York Times. The New York Times gets 2 awards. The Washington Post gets 1. This is, largely seen, I think, yesterday. We saw the hashtag fake news or hashtag fake news awards, both of them trending strongly. And the, pretty much yesterday, in anticipation of the awards, it was just, it was a lot of Trump supporters, I think, just kind of having a good time, having a laugh, taking a poke at the media, who are big boys. They can, and big boys and girls, we can handle it. but today was very different. There were certainly some people supporting and saying thank you for doing what you were doing, but there seemed to be much more of a focused backlash, people concerned about civil liberties. So, for example, here, I think the fake news awards hashtag had a larger audience this year than all the Hollywood award shows and NFL games combined. They don't identify who they are. I think that's probably the definition of fake news right there. But that's okay. They're entitled to their opinion. However, there's a lot of comments here that we're seeing here. Columnist and commentator Wajahat Ali tweeted this: "We laugh about the fake news awards, but in fact, this is quite terrifying and chilling. This is what happens in dictatorships and fascist regimes. Facts, language, truth, and ultimately press become hijacked to serve power." Dr. Deshane Stokes, who is a columnist and a medical doctor, he writes, "The GOP website posting Trump's fake news awards shows the party is complicit in his attacks on free press and those who would hold him accountable. Everything Trump says should be treated as propaganda until independently fact-checked. And the ACLU sent out the president's fake news awards is just the latest, in a long list of attacks against our First Amendment's freedom of press. We have a list as well." So I think an example of how sometimes one story can, just sort of generate some schadenfreude or some, laughs or whatnot, fairly innocently at one side. But then it can turn around and, different people get a hold of the exact same story and bring a whole different set of concerns about that. So it's kind of a fascinating prism through which social media, through which to view something like this.
Many thanks to you, Doug. That is VOA's Doug Bernard. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
What do robots do for laugh? They tell people jokes.
Meet Sophia, an artificial intelligent product designed by David Hanson of Hanson Robotics. He says she's the company's masterpiece, but just the beginning.
I think making social robots with a human-like demeanor can allow us to form durable, bonded relationships with machines.
Of the many challenges, Pascal Fung, engineering professor at Hong Kong University, says getting robots to multitask is among the top.
Compared to toddlers, even when kids are very young, they can do multiple tasks at the same time, and they learn from multiple sensory input.
This Sophia is one of 12 Sophias made by the team of Hanson engineers, fine-tuning her looks and algorithms to make her more lifelike than any other in the world's multi-billion-dollar service robot market. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now, a little something from the world of music.
So beautiful to me.
You know, it's almost impossible to find a song list these days, or any time for that matter, by a male singer that doesn't have a song or many songs about a woman. Whether the music is about love, hate, betrayal, or admiration, women are often the centerpiece when it comes to these songs' lyrics. The most prevalent theme is a woman's beauty. Even Joe Cocker, a British singer and musician known for his gritty style, can't resist telling someone, "You are so beautiful." It's his 1974 hit and cover of a song sung by many popular artists, but it was Cocker that made it a super hit. James Blunt is another singer-songwriter from the UK who was a British Army officer. His song about beauty he co-wrote with Sasha Sharbeck and Amanda Ghost. Newspapers have claimed that "You're Beautiful" is about a former girlfriend of Blunt's, Dixie Chassé, casting director for the Harry Potter films. Blunt refuses to confirm or deny this.
My life is brilliant. Pure. I saw an angel, of that I'm sure. She smiled at me on the subway. She was with another man, but I won't lose no sleep on that, 'cause I've got a plan. You're beautiful, you're beautiful, you're beautiful. I saw your face in a crowded place, and I don't know what to do, 'cause I'll never be with you. Yes, she called. As we walked on by, she could see from my face that I was flying high, and I don't think that I'll see her again, but we shared a moment that will last till the end. You're beautiful, you're beautiful, you're beautiful. Don't know.
Gordon Lightfoot is a Canadian singer-songwriter who's had great success in many genres of music, but almost always sings about imperfect relationships with women. His contribution to songs about beauty is beautiful. It was a super hit for Lightfoot back in the early 1970s.
At times I just don't know how you could be anything but beautiful. Think that I'm made for you, and you were made for me. And I know that I will never change. We've been friends, the rain or shine, for such a long, long time. Laughing eyes and smiling face, it seems so lucky just to have the right, telling you with all my might, you're beautiful tonight.
Amazing. Gordon Lightfoot, huh? From Canada. Remarkable, remarkable singer. Hey, listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. We hope that you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington, and we hope you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Gordon Lightfoot.
And when you hold me tight, how could life be anything but beautiful? Think that I was made for you, and you were made for me. And I know that I will never change. We've been friends, the rain or shine, for such a long, long time. Well, I must say, it means so much. I'm telling you that you're beautiful.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The resignation in November of President Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe has opened a window of opportunity for the long-suffering Zimbabwean people. The nearly four decades-long rule by Mugabe was marked by economic devastation, violence, disregard for the rule of law, and contempt for fundamental human rights. In 2001, the United States began imposing targeted measures against the government of Zimbabwe, including financial sanctions against selected individuals and entities, a ban on transfers of defense items and services, and a suspension of non-humanitarian government-to-government assistance. Nevertheless, as U.S. Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Stephanie Sullivan noted recently in testimony before Congress, the United States has maintained a strong relationship with the Zimbabwean people. Since Zimbabwe's independence in 1980, the United States has provided significant development assistance in the areas of health, food security, education, and economic opportunity for Zimbabwe citizens, though none of the U.S. foreign assistance now involves direct funding to the government. Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Sullivan said the change in Zimbabwe's government offers an opportunity for reform that could allow the United States to engage in ways we have not recently been able to do. That means, she emphasized, that current President Emmerson Mnangagwa must demonstrate his commitment to a democratic, just, healthy, and prosperous Zimbabwe. The U.S. policy for expanded engagement requires a focus on constitutional democracy, free and fair elections, respect for human rights and the rule of law, and an improved trade and investment climate. The country has a strong civil society and an experienced political opposition whose voices must count in charting a path forward, Ms. Sullivan said. The military needs to return to its barracks, and state institutions should be demilitarized. Perpetrators of abuses against civilians should be held accountable, regardless of party affiliation. And the government must engage in hard economic reform, including addressing budget deficits and reducing corruption. if President Mnangagwa wants improved diplomatic relations and access to international assistance and cooperation, particularly with the United States, his government must first implement reforms, declared Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Sullivan. The United States stands ready to help the government and the people of Zimbabwe to achieve these goals. Fundamentally, this will be about the people of Zimbabwe, she added. We want to support their aspirations for a country that can reach its full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Thank you.